heroes, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. First of all, I had a wonderful Metatopia this year. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much to all the listeners who came and said hi and said nice things about the show. I loved meeting some of you and seeing some of you again. I'm very fond of all of you, I have to say. I was on a few panels at this convention that should be available soon. I collaborated with Sarah Richardson on a zine about Con Crash that will be online very soon, and I will share links to all of those things when they are ready. Also, the game that I've been working on, which is a two-player hack of Dread that uses the Jenga Tower to simulate sexual tension between the characters, was very well received. My players were so smart, so insightful. They gave me lots of great feedback, and I'm pretty happy with how things are going. I hope to have a playable beta version of it up and available very soon. So let's jump into today's topic. I've wanted to have Whitney Beltran, or Strix as some of you may know her, on the show basically since I started. And the timing just kind of worked out, as she has a very successful Kickstarter going on right now for Bluebeard's Bride. She's one of the three designers involved in that. I had her on to talk a little bit about Bluebeard's Bride and a lot about Jungian psychology and some other favorite topics. So let's jump right into it.
This Bluebeard's Bride stuff must just be like a roller coaster of goodness.
Oh, man. I don't... Yes.
Short answer, yes.
Good answer, yes. Long answer is I don't know what to do with myself. Yeah. It's fantastic and it's wonderful and it is painfully overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and it's not even done yet. I was talking to Sarah this weekend and I was like, wow, you must be thrilled, you know, with how well it's doing. And she's like, well, it's not over, so it kind of just doesn't feel like it's actually happening yet, which is great.
Yeah, I think all of us are sort of in a state of this is not real life. Mm-hmm. We'll let you know when we get back to real life because this is incongruent with reality.
Well, that's a fun place to be.
Yeah, no complaints, definitely.
Yeah, totally. I saw the sweetest post on your G+ from someone who was saying that for the first time, their wife really wanted to play an RPG and he was like totally over the moon. That was like such like a heart fluttery, like beautiful moment.
That was very, very exciting for me. I think, you know, my whole ethos around gaming is that it should be for everyone and that we should make more games and better games and interesting games outside of the realm of the status quo because other people will join us. And so to kind of have the proof in the pudding, like, ta-da, was just really, really validating. And to know that work that I did, even if it was just one person helped promote that, I was like, good, I'm doing what I have been preaching for so long, and it feels great.
Wow, that's great. I actually, before we even get into too much Bluebeard's Bride stuff, I was just at Metatopia, where you were sorely missed, I have to say.
Yeah, I was sorely missed everyone else, too.
And I got to see... I got to see who won the Golden Cobras this year and all of the awards that were sent out and the honorable mentions.
Yeah. Did you play any of the Golden Cobra games?
I did not actually have time in my completely bonkers schedule to actually play a Golden Cobra game, but I was there for the awards presentation. And it was cool because Jason and Sarah and Jay talked about some of the methodology and how it worked and what they focused on and how they literally just had to like add categories because
yes, we did.
Of certain amazing games.
Yeah, it was really interesting what became emergent out of this year's Golden Cobra. We had 70 entries this year, which is the most ever. And, you know, for American Freeform, that is a lot of games in a year total ever, let alone just for a single contest. And I think one of the things that was special about this year is I think, as you know, I have a Twitch show called Weekly Affirmations, and we play freeform and indie RPGs on that show, and I have a pretty strong community at this point. So I was like, guys, you've been watching me do this for 8 months. I want you to write a game. And so I think like 7 or 8 of my viewers actually followed up and made a game. And these are people outside of our indie community, you know, the Google Plus community, who just have no knowledge of what anything is doing in this space except through the relationship with me and my show. And yet one of them actually won a category which was awesome and fascinating. The game Let's Be Dinosaurs by Javier Batran, who is not related to me, I promise, ended up being one of our winners for the kids category, essentially.
Oh, that's so great. That's right, because the new categories are most kid-appropriate and cutest. Yes. It is my sincere hope that cutest sticks around, because I think that is a very important design goal.
We had so many cute games, and we had so many games that we were like, wow, kids could play this, and that's not something we asked for, but here it is. There's a whole group of them, so let's make a category for it.
Yeah, totally. I wonder, what were the standout games for you this year? What were the games that when you read them, you were like, wow, this is amazing?
So for me personally, I had a couple of favorites. My standout favorite this year was The Porch, actually, which was a winner. I usually pick a favorite to fawn over every year. I can't help myself. The first year it was Still Life, which everyone thought was ridiculous until people actually played it and then they loved it.
Right, the game where you are rocks having existential anxiety.
Yes. Mm-hmm. But it's a really fun game, I promise. But this year, it was definitely The Porch. There are just so many games we wanted to award, but would have gotten like ridiculous. We would have had like 15 awards going out. But Driving While Black was an amazing game.
Okay, well, I heard a little bit about Porch, which the Porch, is that like an intergenerational thing where you play a series of scenes over a couple of years? Was that that one?
No. So The Porch is, it takes place in the South-esque kind of environment. There are a group of students who have just graduated from high school, and they're in that liminal space between being here and moving on. And they have some unresolved questions that they want to get answered about themselves, about each other, about relationships. And I liked it because of the feelings that it evoked. It's sort of this very delicate bittersweetness. You imagine like a hot summer night with iced tea clinking in a cup on a porch as like fireflies wink in and out on the edge of the forest. And for me, that really did it. Yeah. And I think it's a soft, sweet, and again, delicate game. And that really was evoked by the way it was designed and also the text. And so I was like, yeah, The Porch, that's my favorite.
That's beautiful. And it sounds like Driving While Black is not as dreamlike and beautiful and bittersweet.
No, Driving While Black just goes right for, you know, the chin. It doesn't pull any punches at all. It's very straightforward, and it's like, yep, you're going to do this right now, which I thought was fantastic. And that's one of the ones I think that we wanted to award, but really weren't in a place where we could put it exactly where we wanted it. So I know that was also one of Emily Kerbas's favorites as well.
Well, everyone should totally go to goldencobra.org, yes, org, and check out the winners from this year and from previous years, because it's kind of an amazing resource for people who have no familiarity with freeform and want to get into it. But it sounds like it actually came from a pretty specific need, right? This was something that you and other Games on Demand folks at Gen Con and Origins kind of came up with. Tell me about the origin story of the Golden Cobra competition.
Yeah, so basically we as a group of people wanted games that were more accessible, easier to pick up and play with no prep. Because we often run things at conventions, and that has a very specific set of requirements. And so freeform as a design technique and a space just gets along really well with that ethos. And so the first year we got together and we're like, okay, we want to make our lives easy. We want to play interesting games, but we don't want to have to read 15 pages of backstory for each character and have complicated whatever going on. We just want to be able to pick it up and do our thing. And so that was the design constraints, essentially, for the first competition, was like, we want something that you can play at a convention floor with 200 people yelling over you. Figure it out. And people did, and it was fantastic. And so I think there is definitely a gap for games that people can play if they're not familiar with games, which I think is a really important stepping stone to getting more people into games. So I'm very much on the freeform train. And I think designing for accessibility and designing for basically time to impact is very important. There's nothing wrong with having long and complex and drawn out games, but if you want to get people interested and you want to make it easy, I think Freeform is really the place to start. And so I love the Golden Cobra competition because it gives me a catalog of materials to pull from when I'm running my show or if I'm at a con or if I'm trying to explain to a stranger, like, well, what is this really like? And so now that we have sort of this data bank of hundreds of awesome games now, it makes that much easier.
That's beautiful. And I think you're right that a lot of people get intimidated by LARP because their only experience of it is with folks who, okay, they do this once a month, you know, for a weekend, and they've been doing it for a dozen years. And if you haven't, then it's kind of opaque and confusing or whatever. And like, if you can get into that, there's amazing stuff that can happen in that space. And there's amazing stuff that you can do with 20 pages of backstory and 8 hours of your life.
Yes, but that is not realistic for everybody. Games need flexibility. And so we need every kind of game, I think, for every kind of situation.
Yes, absolutely. Now, speaking of making games more accessible to people, this really comes back to the work that you've been doing on HyperRPG with the Weekly Affirmations. You have a really interesting audience there because they're people who are interested in games in a very general sense. But it sounds like you're introducing a lot of people to games that they have not seen or heard of or had very kind of limited familiarity with. And it sounds like it's been a pretty positive response so far from what I can see.
Yeah. So before becoming a Twitch host, I actually had no conception of what Twitch was or how it worked outside of, like, this is where League of Legends players go to yell at each other.
right.
And so I did not have the best impression of Twitch. I thought it was, well, frankly, toxic and not a space for me. But when Zach Eubanks rolled into Seattle and was like, okay, I'm setting up a new channel. It's going to be like Geek & Sundry. It's going to be a variety channel. And I want you to do something on it. What do you want to do? I was like, well, I know what I know best, and that's indie games. Can we do that? And he was like, I have no idea, because that's really weird. And we mostly focus on, like, video games and maybe, like, game shows. But, like, let's give it a shot. What's the worst that can happen? And so I was like, all right, cool. Well, I'm gonna do my thing here. And we're going to play weird games. And I think that the positivity helps a lot. I think being vulnerable and accessible and transparent helps a lot. My motives are very clear. All of my viewers know what I'm about. And they've decided to sign on with that. The show gets pretty decent numbers for Twitch. There's always at least a couple hundred people in there every time I run a game or have a roundtable. But what's more important is actually the community that forms around a show, which is just a thing that happens in Twitch, which I just did not understand before participating in it. And the community becomes self-sustaining in some ways in that they're having conversations without me, they're talking to each other about things that are important to them, they are designing games, which I think is amazing. And they want to know more. And that's all I could really ever really, you know, ask for. So the show's been doing well. It actually just got moved from a non-prom time slot to a prime time slot. So I've moved days. I'm now doing Thursday nights instead of Friday afternoons. And yeah, the viewership is growing. So I just hope I don't run out of games.
What's the time slot so my listeners can jump over there and
yeah.
Watch?
So you can find me Thursday nights at 6 p.m. PST, Pacific Standard Time, on twitch.tv/hyperRPG.
And what has been the experience of working? Because I know that for me, doing a podcast sort of on our own was such a different experience than doing it with a network, with the support of a network. What has it been like working with HyperRPG specifically when you're doing this show in this kind of unfamiliar and actually kind of cutting edge and weird format?
It's actually been fantastic. I don't think I would be doing this show without the support of the studio. HyperRPG takes care of all of the AV work, all of the editing. They help promote through their Twitter. It's really fantastic partnership. Like, I have no complaints. And because I have that support, I can focus on running the games well and getting the players that I want and really thinking about what's going to drive the conversation and also concentrating my energy on creating that space in the channel, you know, in chat, because it is a live stream, what they're talking about, how they're talking to each other, and just making sure that the community is what we want it to be. So that's my role as the host of the show, is to throw down the content and to tell people what I expect from them if they're going to be a part of this community, and also listen to them about what they want as part of the community. So because my hands are free of editing and AV and camera work and all of that, I really get to focus my energy where it's going to be best used. So I love it. I love Hyper-RPG.
Oh, yay. I love that. Yeah, and again, when you have that audience, and then you get to point them to something very physical and tangible and direct and say, okay, if you want to start playing these games, here they are. Like, go to the Golden Cobras, or here's where you can find this game that we were playing. That's really nice, because that's something that I hear from my listeners all the time, is like, oh, after listening to your show, I realized that LARP could theoretically be good. How do I start to make that happen? And if I didn't have the Golden Cobras, I don't really know what I would say to those people a lot of the time.
Right? Because a lot of the one-off LARPs that you would find, like, on the East Coast at Intercon or something, are not really accessible. We all know about Vampire and Nero, but those really aren't good starting places for new people. so, yeah, Golden Cobras, doing the work.
Yes. When I had Sarah Richardson on the show, we talked about Bluebeard's Bride and about archetypes and about the fact that you're making this sort of fairy tale. You have a pretty interesting academic background in death psychology, is that right?
That is correct, 100%.
Mm. And so you're obviously bringing that to your designs. How else do you bring that to your games, either as a GM or a facilitator or as a player?
So I actually have a master's degree in mythological studies with an emphasis in Jungian depth psychology, which sounds super fancy, but it's actually pretty straightforward. And it's the marriage of myth and psychology, specifically with the work of Carl Jung and archetypes, and how archetypes work with our psychology and our understanding of the world. So not too scary, actually. But I would say that it's part of my paradigm of understanding of life. So I bring it everywhere, not just to my design, but also as a player. I'm always thinking about, you know, what archetype am I inhabiting right now? Is it the right archetype at the right time? Do I switch archetypes? What does this archetype have to say to me as a player as I explore it? As a GM, I'm always looking for archetypal behaviors from my players. Where are they going? What do they want to explore? How does that align with archetypal knowledge or things related to archetypal structures that will help guide them or give them scaffolding to go where they want to go? Or they just completely melt that, you know, archetype down and do something else. Cool. But I would say specifically from a design ethos, I think it's very deeply entrenched in me. Everyone designs differently, but for me right now, and this could change, is I always start with what experience do I want people to walk away from the game with? Like, how do I want them to feel? What do I want them to be thinking about? How do I want them to have moved or changed or transformed? And then I design backwards from there. So it's not like, oh, I love the D6 system. What can I make with that? I actually do quite the opposite.
And so how does that differ in terms of when you test and when you design? Especially with LARP, it's really hard to tell what's going on inside of people when they are gaming. Like, if your game is supposed to be funny, you can kind of test and see if they're laughing, but it's so hard to design for a complex internal experience.
Well, I think that's why Bluebeard's Bride took us 2 years, because you gotta, it's like whittling, or it's like carving a piece of marble. You know that the statue is in there, and your job is to cut away the pieces until it's free, essentially. And so with that mindset and using that metaphor, it takes time and it takes good communication with your playtesters. This game would not have been what it was without lots and lots and lots of playtesting. And we would ask those questions like, what did you think about? What worked for you? What did you feel when you did this move? Was it too much? Was it not enough? What do you wish it did? And not every game is like the game that we made, right? There are other games that have different ethoses and are about different kinds of things and have different goals. But for the goals of our game, that was what we wanted, and so that was the way that we approached it.
Horror is such a delicate thing. I played a, I think, fairly early version of Bluebeard's Bride. And I played it with people because I knew that it was designed by people I liked and respected, and it was being run by someone I liked and respected. Horror is, I'm not usually a big fan of it. It feels dangerous. It feels like, oh, I don't know. Is this person going to sort of guide me along this journey that I'm going to find creepy and interesting and frightening, or are they just going to try to shock me? Mm-hmm. How are you approaching horror specifically in a game like this?
So I love horror. Like, as a person, me personally, I'm very interested in horror. I love feminine horror, obviously. I love demonic horror because I was raised Catholic. and I love existential horror. So that's sort of my grab bag of go-to stuff. And I think I can only speak for myself and not Marissa or Sarah, but with this game, I was very familiar with the kind of horror that I wanted to instill. Like, it was a known territory. I had experienced it. So I knew when we were doing moves, if they were pinging right or if they were not pinging right, because it would either feel like, oh yeah, that's accurate, or it would feel like, no, that's not quite right, or it's too much, or it's not enough. So I think horror as a genre is like a sometimes food. Like, it's like cookies. there are other things you should be eating most of the time, but there is something special about it in that it lets us engage with things, maybe in our subconscious or unconscious self, that we're afraid of. And that can be a rewarding experience, not a traumatic one, if we approach it in the right way. I know I certainly find value in it. And so I think I'm trying to share that value with others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot to be said for role-playing as the best version of yourself, or role-playing heroically to see heroic elements in yourself. What is the value, or what do you get out of role-playing with your shadow self and engaging with that aspect of the self?
Ooh, so I think I wrote a whole academic paper on this at you some did. Point
That's
in the last
I'm
year.
Asking.
So for those of you who are listening and are not familiar with the shadow, it's a conception that comes out of Jungian psychology. And the shadow, capital S, is essentially the parts of ourselves which we find unacceptable. And so we repress or push down the aspect of our identity or our being into what is called the shadow. And so there's all kinds of things in the shadow. There are things that society doesn't accept, like being murderous or being a thief. And those things that we can maybe not accept about ourselves, like being cowardly or not being good enough at something. And we push it all down into this shadow, these things that don't get addressed. And at some point in your life, you're going to, I think, feel pushed or pulled or drawn into reincorporating your shadow into an integrated version of who you are. And what I mean by that is basically reconnecting all of the dots between the things that you've cut off about yourself and the things that you embrace so that you're a more whole person. There's a word for that in Jungian psychology. It's called individualization. Usually, individualization in a normal human life, at least in the West, this is very West specific, so it does not apply to other psychological environments. It happens like later in life, like in your 40s or 50s, right? It just kind of naturally starts to emerge, at least according to Carl Jung. With games that specifically address shadow content, things like Bluebeard's Bride, you have an opportunity to get into that bag and see what's going on with, I think, more control and more consciousness, as long as you understand what you are doing. If you don't understand it, you could be, you know, getting into shadow material when maybe you're not ready for it. And that's something that I would advise against. but, man, the shadow is part of who we are. And the more we understand ourselves, the happier we'll be.
Yeah, I could not agree more, actually. even on the side of heroic role playing, even on the side of being a, you know, a quote unquote good guy, I think role-playing, and maybe LARPing probably more specifically, is often reduced to a sort of wish fulfillment or fantasy fulfillment, that we get to do things we don't get to do in our regular life. And sometimes that can be phrased in a very negative way. But from what I've read of your work, you have a really different take on it. And it's not just about being cool or powerful or heroic, but it's getting to engage with heroism and have heroes and have there be heroes.
You did do some research. So I wrote another paper about mythic engagement. And that's really about engagement with archetypal structures and ways of being. And basically, when you engage, rather than just watching, right, a movie or something, when you are physically doing the actions through a LARP in particular, or maybe a tabletop game, you're modeling the behavior, and in some ways, you're absorbing and internalizing it. So when you're internalizing this archetypal structure, this hero structure, you integrate it into yourself. And so you find that you become a more complex person, a more diverse internally and thus harder to assail person. You become more balanced. You basically have deeper roots, right? You're more solid. And so definitely for myself, when I was much younger in life, I used archetypal engagement as almost like a tool in role-playing to sort of teach myself these things about becoming a more whole or a better person through just going through and actually like becoming that archetype for a little while in that game. And then sort of, again, it's like eating, right? You are what you eat. So absorbing that and learning how to do it and then apply it to real life.
Right. Yeah. See what you can carry with you. See what you can keep in your pocket when you come back to the real world. Changing gears quite a bit, you do a lot of work in video games as well, writing and consulting and some things like that, right?
That is true. So I am a writer and narrative designer, not just for tabletop, but for video games as well. So I recently worked on State of Decay 2 with Undead Labs. That's an Xbox title. It's zombies, so that was really fun. But then I also do a lot of diversity and inclusion consulting work. So that's when I go into a big scary boardroom and I'm like, hey guys, you should listen to me because. But mostly I try to help companies navigate diversity and inclusion in a way that's authentic and that will help their bottom line, while also ensuring that minority folks like myself feel more welcomed in gaming and want to participate. So that's a lot of hush-hush work because companies don't usually like talking about it. But I also do just kind of like regular world-building consulting or consulting on indigenous adaptations of mythological stories for video games. So there's this one game, and it's produced by Lienzo Studios. They're actually in Mexico. It's called Mulaka. And Mulaka is about the mythologies of the Rarámuri people, and they're in Chihuahua. And it's kind of like Never Alone, where they take these mythologies, they work directly with these people, and they make a game out of it. I think it's fantastic. It's delicate work because working with indigenous communities, you have to know what you're doing. You want to avoid disenfranchising them. You want to make sure that their voice and participation in this project is authentic. You do not want to appropriate because this is a place where it could really happen in a legitimately bad way. And so it's complicated. But for me personally, I have a deep interest in the possibilities of using video games as a vehicle to basically save indigenous mythologies through iteration. So oral traditions right now are dying, dramatically dying, and it's not good. And when an oral tradition dies, all of the mythologies of that tradition goes with them, and it sort of pushes us closer to a global monoculture, which is not good. We don't want that. And so we need to find a new way of making these tales essentially sticky, like to keep them alive and not just on a piece of paper, but iterating and moving and continuing to exist as a living mythology. And so I think that games are a potential avenue, not the problem solver, but a way of making sure that that happens. And so seeing games like Mulaka and Never Alone start to become commercially successful is very exciting to me. And it's definitely work that I'm interested in pursuing much more deeply as we go forward.
Yeah, absolutely. How does working in the sort of digital game space differ from working in tabletop, or I guess analog games in general?
I mean, they're just entirely different beasts. one is just the sheer amount of money difference. You know, the video game industry is a billion-dollar industry. They have money to throw and resources to throw at a lot of different things. So you can do a lot more things. But it means that it's also slightly more restrictive creatively, and that, like, if someone's going to give you money to do a thing, you better be able to pay the bills with what you produce out of it. It better be commercially successful, or you're not going to get to do it again, period. With tabletop games, and especially with indie games, it's a much smaller, much, much smaller industry. The industry is in the millions, right? Maybe in the tens of millions. I don't think more than that. Very, very tiny, actually, monetarily. And they're easier to make. They're more accessible. Writing something down and laying it out and then putting it on PDF is a much simpler process than coding in Unity and distributing it through Steam. And so the space is just more agile, actually. It moves faster. It's more progressive. The thought iterates faster. And we're doing more and different things. But these games don't have the same reach as video games. So there's pros and cons to both. And I think what I hope to see soon is more people like me bridging the gap between analog and video games. There's a few of us, but I actually think the more of us that can straddle both realms, the healthier each industry will be.
I don't know if you noticed, but at IndieCade this year, there were a number of freeform games, still life made it to IndieCade.
Oh, I definitely noticed. I definitely noticed. I was super pleased that Still Life made it IndieCade. I felt invasion of the freeform games. It was a really great moment.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I haven't spoken to anyone who was actually at IndieCade, like at the con, but I'm very excited to see, like, how did people engage with that? What was that like? What kind of cross-pollination is happening? And it is funny because video games are so much bigger, almost everybody in analog games is to some extent following the video game world, even if it's in a very cursory way. I'm really, really excited to see what happens when the opposite starts happening.
I think we're starting to see that pivot. It may not be a big one, but they're definitely going, oh, they're doing something over there. What is it?
What are those people up to? It sounds like you have a lot on the go. Is it too early to ask what is going to come after Bluebeard's Bride?
So I don't think it's too early to ask, but it might be too early to have an answer that actually bears fruit. I'm already working on another thing. I've been working on it tangentially for like maybe the last 6 months or so. It's actually not a tabletop game. It's a Twine game. Are you familiar with Twine?
Of course, yeah. I've made a bunch of Twine games.
Excellent. So this is actually going to be my first foray into Twine. But I am actually planning to work with two other women, not Marissa and Sarah, but two other women here in Seattle on a Twine game. And we have the story, we have the conception, and now we're kind of mapping out, you know, how it's going to work and what coding we need and what our assets we need, and then doing all the story mapping, which is my main job. And so we'll see how it goes. I don't have any, like, expectations of it. It's Twine, so it's not like it's going to be a commercial success like Bluebeard. But I think stepping away from tabletop for a hot second and exploring this other thing is what I'm sort of being called to do right now. So I'm going to do a Twine game. And the idea is to do a derivative off of a different set of fairy tales, the Tenyo myths out of Japan, and adapt those into hopefully a really hard-hitting, gut-wrenching, but not quite as terrible as Bluebeard's story. I think it would be more of a tragedy than a horror game. Or maybe not a tragedy. There might be some hope there. We'll see.
But depends on your ending, I guess. Tell me more about the Tenyo myths. I'm not familiar with them.
So in different parts of Japan, there are these myths around the Tenyo, also called Tenchi if it's male, but Tenyo if it's female. And basically these are celestial beings or angels, though not quite in the Western understanding, who come down to Earth every once in a while and hang out. And there's this one Tenyo myth called the Fisherman's Wife. And I don't call it the Fisherman's Wife outside of talking about the Tenyo stuff because there's actually a Western fairy tale called The Fisherman's Wife, and it's very different, and we're not doing that.
Right, got it.
So we're not doing the one with the wishes and the jealous, greedy wife. We're doing the one where basically this this angel comes down to Earth, and she bathes in a tide pool on the edge of the ocean, and a fisherman steals her magical robes. And because of that, she cannot return to heaven. So she's, like, stuck on Earth. And then she becomes his wife, and they have kids. And then the myth goes that the kids, when they get older, they find her robe, and they secretly sing her a song, telling her where the robe is. And in the game, at least my idea so far, this could all change, is that obviously there's going to be some very poignant choices that you have to make as this woman. Like, do you love your children? Are you going to stay? Are you going to take your robes and descend back to your rightful place in heaven? Even though your husband captured you, essentially, and it was a terrible story, do you kind of love him? And what does that mean? And is that terrible? And but maybe it's not. So the idea is to unpack a lot of emotions around domestic life as a woman through these metaphors, and we'll see where it goes. It's going to take some time to sort out, but I think I'm onto something. So,
well, it's already breaking my heart. You know, like you don't have to stretch very far to see how that is just really, really resonant with, I think, a lot of women in their relationship to families, domestic life, relationships, self fulfillment. Wow, you've wife, woof.
So that's the idea. And obviously I'm pulling from Western themes too. I'm kind of very interested in The Awakening. You know, the book that came out in the 1800s. Oh, or maybe it was later than that. But basically about the woman who has two sons and ends up committing suicide, which sounds dark and deep when you actually read it.
The Kate Chopin novel.
Yes, Chopin. You can tell it's Monday morning. But yeah, Chopin's The Awakening, I think, plus the Tenyo myths, somewhere in that gray space in between is what I am going for, but maybe not quite.
That's really interesting, the idea of drawing on a bunch of different traditions. I mean, in Bluebeard's Bride, even there, that's one of those myths that has a lot of different versions. And in what way are you kind of both drawing from and contributing to? Like, do you feel like you're contributing to the Bluebeard's Bride myth by making a game like this?
So actually, yes. It did not dawn on me that we were contributing to the body of work in a real way until, weirdly, we got the art in for it. And then I was like, wow, this art is so impactful, because the art for Bluebeard's Bride is beautiful. I think it's gorgeous. But I was like, oh, we're actually adding to the opus and body of what this tale means. And I don't know why it was the art that triggered that for me, but I was like, oh, this is a thing. And I think, you know, there's lots of different retellings of the Bluebeard story, and there's the traditional French, and then there's what happens afterwards, and then there's the women's empowerment version. And I think what we're saying is, for ourselves, you can tell a version of the story from the point of view and the perspective of the feminine, and it doesn't mean that you have to overwrite it. It's good to overwrite it and to rewrite it and to be triumphant. That's awesome. What we also need in this space, though, is a way to simply just unpack it and let it be and let it sit there with us and understand what it is and what that, how that changes us and what it makes us. I think what we're doing is we're helping to build nuance into the understanding of the feminine. We're not just like one note, like, yay, girl power, triumph. We're actually saying, no, actually, our experiences are much more complex than that. And that is a great aspect of what happens when women tell their own stories, but that's not the only aspect.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. And there's something about sort of trying to save oral traditions by writing them down that, no matter how well-intentioned, it often ends up being really exploitative. And I do think that when you write down a story, you're sort of keeping it alive and you're kind of killing it at the same way, at the same time.
Yeah, I actually feel very strongly that writing down oral traditions kills them.
Yes, yes. Oh my gosh, yes, thank you.
Because then they become stuck there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And before they weren't stuck. They were always moving and changing and evolving. And when you write it down, suddenly it's struck dead. It's like a bird that falls from the sky. And so that's why I like games much better, because they continue the conversation.
Gosh, I was talking to someone about Little Red Riding Hood a while ago, and they were like, oh, do you mean in the original? Or like, have you read the original? I was like, no one has read the original. Like, there is no original. Like,
yeah, there's no such thing.
Really not a thing. Yeah. And even a lot of the attempts to sort of write down a lot of what we would consider the Western or European fairy tales were just like dudes showing up to people's houses, stealing their stories, writing them down, and then trying to sell them back to them. I think games are kind of uniquely positioned to be able to continue that conversation. Because the other way to kill a myth is to just stop telling it, and then it also disappears incidentally.
Yeah, which is also not great.
So not the best.
we need that variety of thought, right? We need it to be a sustainable culture. So the less we have, the poorer we are intellectually and spiritually.
And I feel like that feeds into a lot of the work, or that is in harmony with a lot of the work that you're doing around diversity and inclusion as well. Like, diversity isn't just sort of an abstract, like, good to have, coincidentally good for your bottom line or your whatever. It really is just about, like, richness and sustainability.
Yeah, I think it's actually about a lot of things. And that's why actually it's not easy work to do, but I have always enough to say. Because when you're talking to a company, for instance, it is absolutely true that it is going to help their bottom line. When they open up their games to more diverse audiences, like, they'll just get more market share, right? Period. It is also true that, like, people who are minorities are going to feel less alienated, more integrated, more welcomed, happier. And then thirdly, it is also true that as a culture and as a growing monoculture, that these diversity initiatives are very important for us to maintain diversity of thought and to not stagnate and to maintain spiritual aspects of ourselves. We can be secular and be spiritual, or we can be religious and be spiritual. It doesn't really matter, but we need to have some component of that in order to be sort of whole, I think. That's my opinion.
Yeah. And I mean, what kinds of things, I know you're probably like under a mountain of NDAs, so you don't have to be specific, but what kinds of things do you see when you get brought into a company that at least has an interest in diversity, even if they're not sure what that means or what that's going to look like, or even what their issue is?
So most of them are like good folks, and they just don't have the fluency in what the issues are or how to do anything about it. So they aren't doing it. And so a lot of my work is showing them what is going on, like teaching them like how to read the pulse, and then basically integral mistakes not to make and how to think about these things. And so usually it's just because they're unaware. It's not because they're like nefarious bad guys who just want to make the bottom dollar. They just don't know. And so that is actually a great starting place, because then we can go, okay, well, what do you want to do? What kind of community do you want to have around your games? And who do you want to talk to, and why do you want to talk to them, and what do you have to say? I think being positive and encouraging is super integral to this work, which can be tiring at times, because sometimes you just want to shake people and be like, why don't you understand? but I'll, you know, I think everyone wants to do right, and they just need to be given the tools to do so. And so a lot of the times I will challenge companies to take risks, and they hate taking risks because they're companies, and that's normal. But I'm like, hey, maybe you should try this thing, or maybe you should try that thing, or, well, you have an opportunity here. There's no reason why you shouldn't take it. Maybe you should do this thing. Like, maybe you should make that character gay, or maybe you should work on this art so that it's not from the male gaze. And they're like, what's the male gaze? And I have to be like, okay, well, let's start there.
You pull down the chart from the scene.
So it's very fruitful work, because then once someone else starts to get it, then they can sort of onboard other people around them too and start influencing the culture as well. So it's not like one person or a set of people has to carry all these changes. It's a cumulative effect, like ripples.
Are you starting to see the impact of what that company does start to affect other people, like their sort of quote-unquote competitors, because that would be the most satisfying thing in the world, right? To see your recommendations in companies that haven't even hired you.
I think the answer is yes, it's happening, but it's really hard to quantify and say, I did that thing. So they talked to that person and that person made a different decision about how they were going to do their games. I think it's more of a sensing of the sea change. I think the sea change is happening. It's happening much faster in tabletop than it is in video games, but it is happening in video games.
I mean, I'm thinking really of the work that Paizo is doing with Pathfinder, mm-hmm. where they've done a lot of really good stuff in terms of representation and in terms of making their games really accessible to folks and not leaving folks out in a way that, you know, other sort of big company fantasy games have. Mm-hmm. And I love seeing Paizo do that, but I love the idea of other companies that are in the same market as them kind of looking at each other and be like, Paizo's doing really well.
Yeah.
Let's check out this thing where their trans characters aren't horrible. Maybe there's something to that mm-hmm. or whatever.
Well, yeah, I do think we actually saw that with D&D 5th edition. I think Paizo's own moves pushed them into their little clauses about gender and playing who you want to play. I think that's actually a direct result of Paizo's moves to open that area up. So yeah, they are affecting each other.
That's so cool to see. What are your hopes for tabletop? Like, if you could look into the future and see the role playing community, LARP and freeform and tabletop a decade from now, what do you want that to look like?
Oh man, I have so many wants.
Share your dreams.
My dreams would be that there would be a vast array of different kinds of games in different settings with different kinds of people. And what I mean is, like, maybe there's a game that's about New Orleans and it focuses on the African-American community. Maybe there's a game about colonists on the moon, but they're all Somalian. Maybe there's one about, you know, the Appalachian folks and the coal miners and who they became after technology. I want to see as many different kinds of stories being told as possible. I want to be able to go and authentically pick up a game and have a great experience with something that I've never experienced before in my life. So I want to see the proliferation, I think, of what I would call minority settings and minority understandings baked into games, and just have just like a bazillion different kinds of games to pick from. The other thing that I would love to see from the tabletop and the LARP community is better awareness about, gosh, this sounds so cheesy, but the transformative power of games, both for the good and the bad. To be aware that what they're doing is affecting themselves, their mental health, their understanding of self, their well-being, and that we become much more aware as a community of toxic behaviors and toxic kinds of role-playing in both tabletop and LARP. And I don't mean just individuals, but like systemic toxicity that happens in certain kinds of games and how we should avoid that. And basically people taking games, I guess, seriously, not like super seriously, but like understanding that they actually have some leverage in their own lives, and that, you know, you should pick what you play judiciously and you should have fun at the same time. That's one that I don't know will happen, but I would love to see as a myth and psychology expert. I really think that there is a lot of knowledge for the community to gain. And then I guess is the third thing is our community is really scattered. We're like a bunch of island nations right now that communicate via conch. Like, we don't connect well. And so we're all designing in sort of our own little black boxes and reinventing the wheel. And communities can be light years ahead or behind of each other, or just not be up to even the same nomenclature, like having conversations and using words that each other don't know about design. I would love to see better interconnectivity and better integration of the gaming community as a whole, so that people can kind of get on the same page.
Yeah, yeah. Oh my goodness. I saw so much of that at Living Games this year, and even actually at Magiscola this year, which was not a conference. And oh, absolutely. Magic Scholar was not intended to be a knowledge sharing, community building, you know, thing, but it did just coincidentally was very attractive to lots of people from lots of different LARP traditions. So they all met each other and then kept talking afterwards after the experience. And so many people were like, oh, you do that in your LARPs in like Pennsylvania? We do this in our LARPs in California. And we've never spoken before. We didn't even know each other exists. But now all of a sudden we're starting to build some of the same language. And those relationships are not just built on like mutual interest, but they're built on this like beautiful, intense emotional experience of Magic Scholar. So between those two things, like I can at least tell you that last thing, 2016 has been pretty cool for that.
That's awesome.
I'm really optimistic.
I actually just had an experience here in Seattle, which is, you know, a hotbed of game design where I thought everyone was super connected. I went to a LARP, a commercial LARP, so one that you actually pay for, hosted by people that I didn't know. And I was like, cool, I'm going to go to this LARP and have a good time. And I did go to the LARP and I did have a good time. But when they were briefing everyone, there were no safety techniques introduced at all. And this was like a horror LARP. So not only was it just a regular LARP, but like people wearing masks and there were some people that were more vulnerable to other people. And I was like, whoa, 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 folks. I really hate to be that guy, but can we talk about safety techniques? And they're like, what are you talking about? And I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is why I want us to be connected. Because if everyone was part of the same conversation, gaps like that just wouldn't happen.
Yeah. And we would have even better safety tools, right? Because if a larger number of people are thinking about that, like, I am so excited for us in a decade to look back and be like, my gosh, can you believe we used cut and break? Oh, we thought that was the best way to do things. How?
What fools we were. Dark.
Yeah, exactly. Good for you for stepping outside your comfort zone and going to a LARP by people that you didn't know, though. I hope that was educational or helpful or cool or fun or something.
It was really fun, and I had a good time. But it was clear to me that like our island nation syndrome is still a super big deal.
So true. Yeah, there's still kind of an archipelago. You should come to Living Games 2018.
Yeah, I heard it was great this last year.
It was, and I'm really excited for it to be bigger. So, Twitch channel, Thursday nights on Hyper RPG, weekly affirmations, it's beautiful. Bluebeard's Bride on Kickstarter right now. Your blog is Strixworks, which you do post on from time to time.
Yes, from time to time.
From time to time. Let's see, goldencobra.org to go and see all of the beautiful Golden Cobra games and play them with your friends. Other things that are in the works or that you'd like to direct people to or remind people of? Anything else?
Oh man, there's always so much on my plate at one time. So Strixworks, and it's Strixwerks, because I just had to, is my main hub for what I'm doing. The blog gets updated like once every 6 months or so. But my convention schedule usually is up to date. All of my papers are linked there. All of the gaming is other work that I do. So all of the videos and the podcasts and the articles is up there. And so that's like the nexus place for anything related to me. It's where you can get to my academia.edu profile. It's where you can get to my Twitter and my Google+. So that's a great place to start. I am fairly active on Twitter. And I'm the_Strix over there. But basically, what I've got going on right now, as you said, is Bluebeard's Bride, Weekly Affirmations, the diversity inclusion work, which is ongoing, and then, you know, a couple of projects, which, yeah, NDAs.
Of course, yeah. That's how it rolls. Mm-hmm. If I've got game designers listening who are working with myths or different cultures or who are interested in diversity, commercially, should they reach out and contact you and get some consultation happening?
Yes, they absolutely should, especially if they're working with indigenous mythologies or mythologies outside of the Western conceptualization. I actually just finished up work for Scion by Onyx Path, where I did a lot of the groundwork for how we were going to deal with our mythologies in this game, but also I wrote the basics for the Aztec pantheon, so that was really fun. Cool. So yes.
That's rad. I'm really, really glad because I think there are a lot of people who really want to do it right and just straight up are not sure where to go, not sure what the next steps are to make that happen.
Yep. Talk to advocates like me. We want to help.
Yay, helping. Okay, well, it was super great to chat with you. This was really, really fun. When's your next con? What's your con schedule for the immediate future like?
So for the immediate future, I believe I will be guest of honor next at OrcaCon here in Seattle. I am planning on attending GDC. There's just a couple of things that need to be worked out on the back end. I'm really sad I missed Metatopia. But, you know, the usuals like PAX and a couple of others here on the West Coast. And then I'm going to try to get to at least one East Coast con in 2017. So we'll see how that works out.
Okay, awesome. Well, hopefully we'll get to see each other again soon.
Yes, definitely.
All right. Bye.
Well, thanks again to Strix for joining us. And as always, thank you for listening. Remember that if you want to get in touch, you can always send me an email. That's backstorypodcast@gmail.com. You can find me on Google+. That's Backstory Podcast. Or you can follow me on Twitter @BackstoryCast. Backstory is part of the One Shot Podcast Network. You can find more great shows like One Shot, Campaign, Modifier, Talking Tabletop, and many more at oneshotpodcast.com. Music for Backstory is provided by Ujiko. The track is called Thinking of You. You can hear more from them at soundcloud.com/Ujiko. Talk to you later, heroes.